Welcome to another edition of McAllister Faculty Talks, a weekly series highlighting the work of McAllister professors. In celebration of the holiday season, President Rosenberg is going to read an excerpt from Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. So, go ahead.
Thank you. Before I start reading, just a word about A Christmas Carol. Starting in 1843 and then for the next 5 or 6 years, Dickens published about once a year a Christmas book, and he did this, as Dickens did most things, for several different reasons. First, he had, throughout his life, an excess of energy and was always looking to fill his time with one project or another. And so in between writing his novels, he would edit magazines and be in theatrical productions and take long walks and write Christmas books. Another of his goals was always to entertain a large audience, and he knew that Christmas books would do that. And a third, and never least important for Dickens, was to make more money, of which he felt he never had enough. And the Christmas books were, during his lifetime, a major source of income for him. So the two short passages that I would like to read are from A Christmas Carol. They're very well known, and they connect with one another. This first is from the early portion of the story when Scrooge, prior to being visited by any ghosts, is visited by two men who are soliciting for a charity. And it reads as follows. This lunatic, in letting Scrooge's nephew out, had let two other people in. They were portly gentlemen, pleasant to behold, and now stood with their hats off in Scrooge's office. They had books and papers in their hands and bowed to him. "Scrooge and Marley's, I believe," said one of the gentlemen, referring to his list. "Have I the pleasure of addressing Mr. Scrooge or Mr. Marley?" "Mr. Marley has been dead these 7 years," Scrooge replied. "He died 7 years ago, this very night." "We have no doubt his liberality is well represented by his surviving partner," said the gentleman presenting his credentials. It certainly was, for they had been two kindred spirits. At the ominous word liberality, Scrooge frowned and shook his head and handed the credentials back. "At this festive season of the year, Mr. Scrooge," said the gentleman, taking up a pen, "it is more than usually desirable that we should make some slight provision for the poor and destitute who suffer greatly at the present time. Many thousands are in want of common necessaries. Hundreds of thousands are in want of common comfort, sir."
"Are there no prisons?" asked Scrooge.
"Plenty of prisons," said the gentleman, laying down the pen again.
"And the union workhouses?" demanded Scrooge. "Are they still in operation?"
"They are. Still," returned the gentleman. "I wish I could say they were not."
"The treadmill and the poor law are in full vigor, then?" said Scrooge.
"Both are very busy, sir."
"Oh, I was afraid from what you said at first that something had occurred to stop them in their useful course," said Scrooge. "I'm very glad to hear of it."
"Under the impression that they scarcely furnish Christian cheer of mind or body to the multitude," returned the gentleman, "a few of us are endeavoring to raise a fund to buy the poor some meat and drink and means of warmth. We choose this time because it is a time of all others when want is keenly felt and abundance rejoices. What shall I put you down for?"
"Nothing," Scrooge replied.
"You wish to be anonymous?"
"I wish to be left alone," said Scrooge. "Since you ask me what I wish, gentlemen, that is my answer. I don't make merry myself at Christmas, and I can't afford to make idle people merry. I help to support the establishments I have mentioned. They cost enough, and those who are badly off must go there."
"Many can't go there, and many would rather die."
"If they would rather die," said Scrooge, "they had better do it and decrease the surplus population. Besides, excuse me, I don't know that."
"But you might know it," observed the gentleman.
"It's not my business," Scrooge returned. "It's enough for a man to understand his own business, and not to interfere with other people's. Mine occupies me constantly. Good afternoon, gentlemen." Seeing clearly that it would be useless to pursue their point, the gentlemen withdrew. Scrooge resumed his labors with an improved opinion of himself and in a more facetious temper than was usual with him. The second short passage I will read comes at the end of Scrooge's visit with the ghost of Christmas present and forms a kind of bookend with the first passage. The chimes were ringing the 3/4 past 11 at that moment. "Forgive me if I am not justified in what I asked," said Scrooge, looking intently at the spirit's robe. "But I see something strange and not belonging to yourself protruding from your skirts. Is it a foot or a claw?" "It might be a claw, for the flesh there is upon it," was the spirit's sorrowful reply. "Look here." From the foldings of its robe it brought two children, wretched, abject, frightful, hideous, miserable. They knelt down at its feet and clung upon the outside of its garment. "Oh, man, look here. Look, look down here," exclaimed the ghost. They were a boy and girl, yellow, meager, ragged, scowling, wolfish, but prostrate too in their humility. Where graceful youth should have filled their features out and touched them with its freshest tints, a stale and shriveled hand like that of age had pinched and twisted them and pulled them into shreds. Where angels might have sat enthroned, devils lurked and glared out menacing. No change, no degradation, no perversion of humanity in any grade, through all the mysteries of wonderful creation has monsters half so horrible and dread. Scrooge started back, appalled. Having them shown to him in this way, he tried to say they were fine children, but the words choked themselves, rather than be parties to a lie of such enormous magnitude. "Spirit, are they yours?" Scrooge could say no more. "They are man's," said the spirit, looking down upon them, "and they cling to me, appealing from their fathers. This boy is ignorance. This girl is want. Beware them both, and all of their degree, but most of all, beware this boy. For on his brow I see that written which is doom, unless the writing be erased." "Deny it," cried the spirit, stretching out its hand toward the city. "Slander those who tell it ye. Admit it for your facetious purposes and make it worse, and bide the end." "Have they no refuge or resource?" cried Scrooge. "Are there no prisons?" said the spirit, turning on him for the last time with his own words. "Are there no workhouses?" The bell struck 12.
Why did you choose those passages?
I think they remind us that even as he was trying to entertain, Dickens always had a social purpose. One of the things he was responding to very directly in A Christmas Carol was something that became known as the Poor Laws that were passed in 1834 and established institutions like workhouses. And in Dickens' mind, removed a lot of the responsibility for taking care of the poor and the elderly and the sick from individuals, transferred it to the state, and in that way removed individual responsibility. Dickens was a strong opponent, as were many other Victorian writers and thinkers of the Poor Laws. So I think it reminds us that even as he was entertaining, he was always a pretty harsh social critic.
Didn't he start probably one of the first programs for inner city kids? And
he did a lot like that. He did programs for children. He started programs and participated in programs for women who became unmarried mothers, for women who became prostitutes. They weren't always the most humane programs. The answer to situations like that was often doing things like shipping the women to Australia. So there were aspects of these programs that we probably wouldn't consider very progressive today. But Dickens did try through his time and his resources and his writing to address social causes. The one thing he consistently refused to do was run for office himself. He was invited repeatedly to run for Parliament, and he always declined.
Shifting gears a little bit, you mentioned that he wrote a lot of Christmas books. Why do you think this one was so popular? I mean, in its first printing, it sold out 6,000 copies. So
I think there's something so fundamental about the character of Scrooge. He has, in a relatively short time, become an archetype. And there is something that is almost mythic about this story of someone who transforms literally overnight, about these three spirits that embody different aspects of the world, different aspects of his life. He clearly, as he did often in his books, managed to capture something that was both deeply familiar to people, but also somehow original. For Dickens, it's almost always the characters, I think, that drive the narratives and that drive the popularity of the books.
Didn't this book come out at a time when the traditions of Christmas were sort of waning in popular culture, and this sort of revived the interest in the tradition?
I think part of it was revival, part of it was creation. I think that in many ways what we tend to think of as the modern family Christmas is a creation of the 19th century. And Dickens is probably as responsible for that creation as anyone. Mm-hmm. And so I think part of it was reviving the ceremonies and the trappings of Christmas, but part of it really was creating it. And I think he is probably as responsible for better or worse, for the Hallmark version of Christmas that exists today.
Well, thank you for taking the time to talk with us today. For McAllister Faculty Talks, I'm Julie Hooker.